Kunstradio. Radio Kunst. Ö1 in 5.1 Surround.
Helmut Jasper begrüßt Sie sehr herzlich zu einer Live-Performance in 5.1 Surround mit dem Titel Creative Life von und mit Bob Ostertag. Der renommierte amerikanische Künstler und Musiker Ostertag stellt für Kunstradio eine radiophone Collage von Texten aus seinem aktuellen Buch Creative Life, Music, Politics, People and Machines über seine Arbeiten der letzten 30 Jahre zusammen. Eingearbeitet sind einige der zahlreichen Aufnahmen Bob Ostertags, eine Art Biografie in nicht nur musikalischen Fragmenten. Ostertag ist der Welt vor allem als elektronischer Musiker bekannt. Er hat über 20 Alben veröffentlicht und durch seine Präsenz und Prägung der mittlerweile schon legendären New Yorker Downtown-Szene in den 80er Jahren. Ostertag arbeitete mit Musikern aus vielen Genres, etwa John Rose, dem Kronos Quartett, John Zorn, Mike Patton, Anthony Braxton und vielen anderen. Als wäre das noch nicht genug, ist er außerdem als Journalist und Lateinamerika-Aktivist unterwegs. In seinem Buch erstreckt sich die Themenpalette vom Bürgerkrieg in El Salvador bis zum Transvestiten-Untergrund in San Francisco. Mr. Ostertag, it's great to have you here. Good evening.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Mr. Ostertag, in your book, Creative Life, you are discussing a very wide range of topics from art to politics. I'd like to quote from a review that was written by Roddy Schrock, I think it's a colleague of yours. He writes, "The book is equal parts personal search for common ground between his music and his political activism, as well as testament to the importance of following your internal compass, even if it makes little sense at the time." Mr. Ostertag, did you find the common ground between your artistic work and your journalist work?
Oh, I'd say that's an ongoing project. In fact, tonight's reading is part of that project, and writing this book is part of that project. It will never finish. It's a process, not an end.
So you think that that will always be a path, but nothing that can ever be fulfilled?
Yes, but I think you could say the same about anything worthwhile.
It will stay a fragment.
I like a path better than a fragment.
Mm-hmm. And you also try to help. I think it's more like a letter to young artists to say, okay, if you fail, it doesn't really make any difference. You just have to stay at your path, at your moral and ethic values, right?
Well, you know, failing and success is not really something I'm so interested in. I don't know if I failed or I succeeded. It's not really the yardstick that I really think about. But is it meaningful for me? Did anyone benefit? And was I happy doing it? Those are good, better questions than failure or success.
And how would you describe your internal compass?
Whew.
Especially we have, I'm sure we have a lot of young artists listening to your show tonight. So
my internal compass is that I would like to see people with less have more. I'd like to see people spend their time doing creative things, and I'd like to not destroy the planet.
So I think we leave you now with your performance, and thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. In 1939, Edgard Varèse, the composer who first articulated a grand vision of how machines would change the way humans made music, announced that sound-producing machines promise nothing less than the, quote, liberation of music. Varèse said, if you are curious to know what such a machine could do that the orchestra, with its man-powered instruments, cannot do, I shall try briefly to tell you. Whatever I write, whatever my message, it will reach the listener unadulterated by interpretation. From late modernists like Karlheinz Stockhausen, down through rock experimentalists like Frank Zappa, and now to the thousands of DJs who pump electronic sound through dance clubs, the idea that electronic music would give composers more control while freeing them from relying on human relationships to realize their musical ideas has been the dominant thrust in electronic music. The notion of the machine as a perfect interpreter of musical ideas, in contrast to the necessarily flawed interpreter that is human, has gone unchallenged. My work has gone in a substantially different direction. My experience of using electronic technology to make music was never one of machines as ideal musicians over whom I could exercise perfect and exquisite control. I didn't really see that as a problem, however, as the unpredictable and unruly behavior of the machines I worked with quickly became my muse. However, as the years have gone by, the meaning I attach to this unstable and tense relationship between human and machine has evolved substantially. Began my Say No More project by asking the players to go into recording studios separately, with no communication with each other nor instruction from me, and record solo improvisations. I took the tapes that they recorded and, using a computer, exploded these solos into fragments and then assembled an ensemble piece by piece from the splinters. The result became the 1992 Say No More CD. At that point, the group had a CD, but by conventional reckoning, had yet to play a note together. Orthodox score of the compositions I had created on the computer using the solo improvisations as sources. I gave the musicians both their score and the computer-assembled recordings on CD and ask them to learn their parts. After extremely limited rehearsal, we then recorded a live CD at ORF Radio in Vienna, Say No More in person. So this second CD was a live ensemble performing compositions made on a computer out of fragments of the members' solo improvisations. Then put these live ensemble recordings back into the computer, exploded them into fragments, and created a new computer-based work, Verbatim, released on CD in 1996. And finally, I created a score of Verbatim and gave it back to the ensemble along with the recording and asked the members to learn these new parts. The group toured the new material and then recorded a fourth CD in concert in Belgium in 1998. Thus, the project involves a human virtual cycle. First, live solos disappear into the computer and are transformed into music concrete compositions. These emerge from the computer to become ensemble compositions and performances. The live ensemble performances disappear back into the computer and are transformed into new music concrete compositions, and these finally emerge back into human performance. Cultural milieu of the 1960s and early 1970s fundamentally shaped my early interest in synthesizers and electronic music. Jimi Hendrix had transformed the electric guitar into a radically new instrument that was much more than just an amplified version of an acoustic guitar. Miles Davis was incorporating electric sound into music that traced its lineage to the jazz tradition. John Cage, David Tudor, and many others were putting electronic sound at the center of the avant-garde. The prevailing view of technology and society was captured in the Whole Earth Catalog, a sort of operating manual for the counterculture, which sold millions of copies around the world and always seemed to be lying around wherever people with a countercultural bent congregated. Via the jumbled pages of the catalog, one could buy books by Buckminster Fuller, learn how to tell the age of a cow, identify edible plants, and order composting toilets or Moog synthesizers. The common thread through this eclectic collage was that every item was seen by the editors as a tool for personal empowerment. The motivating idea was that access to tools, which was the catalog's subtitle, would lead to a more peaceful and enlightened culture through the diffusion of knowledge and know-how. It was no coincidence that the catalog was published out of the area south of San Francisco that would later become known as Silicon Valley, for the social circle from which the catalog emerged also produced the personal computer. Parts for the very earliest personal computers were available through the catalog, and the publishers hoped that the widespread adoption of personal computers would lead to a radical democratization of society. Today, these ideas seem anachronistic and hopelessly naive. Our current access to tools is without precedent. Our lives are inundated with digital tools that promise to improve communication, but seem only to make us more alienated. Electronic music has exploded out of the avant-garde to become the deafening monochrome background roar of wired yet disconnected culture. Discarded consumer electronics are piling up in landfills in Africa, leaching their heavy metals into the already impoverished soil. Every technological advance seems to bring a further erosion of privacy, a new kind of violence, and another environmental disaster. It's harder and harder to see anything empowering in all of this. In the 1970s, when I was a student, my teacher, Derry John Mizell, suggested that instead of using technology to make new sounds, I should try to use technology to create new relationships between musicians. Our ears, he argued, are fast learners. The first time we hear a sound we have never heard before, we perceive the sound as new. And in the 1970s, the sound of electronically synthesized music was indeed new in this sense for many people. But this newness is very short-lived, and sounds we have only recently been introduced to quickly become as familiar as those we have heard our entire lives. Derry John felt that by using technology to create new human relationships instead of new sounds, a more fruitful artistic practice could be forged. Derry John was an inspiring teacher, and I attempted to follow his advice. But as I proceeded, when I stood back and looked at the body of work I was building, what stood out was not the technologically mediated relationships between musicians, but the confrontational relation of musicians and machines. In fact, one could easily place my work in a narrative of increasingly explicit awareness of this shift. I began the Say No More project with my focus on the relationships I would create between myself as composer and the ensemble members as improvisers. But as soon as the group got together and began to play the compositions I had made, it became obvious that the tension between the musicians as flesh and blood humans and their digitized mirror image on the computer was where the real action was. This realization caused me to reconsider all my previous work in that light. And since that time, the focal point of my work has been on the confrontation of human and machine.
Giddy up, cowboy! Giddy up! Ha, ha, ha! Giddy up! Hey, this isn't a Western. They said this picture was gonna be a Western.
I came to see some horses in shoes galloping, just galloping. I want to see a gunfight at the OK Corral.
Once all the hoopla dies, it seems that what we are left with is the same old relationships in new packaging. What changes is not so much our relationships with each other, but our relationship with technology, and by extension, our relationship with the natural world.
A big old flying around our head. I want to see more cattle making some kettle fried potato chips. I want to see Destry ride again. I do. I really, really, really do. I want to see gingham petty skirts. I want to see some sort of action out on the street outside the saloon. Wanna just throw down my quarter and get a shot of whiskey. And then I ain't gonna be responsible for anything I do, cause this is the Wild West. We're out here in the Wild West.
Joel Chattopee wrote a book called Electronic Sound, The Past and Promise of Electronic Music. This is a standard introductory text to the subject of electronic music used in universities around the world. Chattopee starts off his book by setting up the conservative American composer John Philip Sousa as his straw man. Chattopee has Sousa complaining about the intrusion of machines into the world of music, and quotes Sousa asking, "When a mother can turn on a phonograph, with the same ease that she applies to the electric light, will she croon her baby to sleep with sweet lullabies, or will the infant be put to sleep by machinery?"
Giddy up.
To Chattopee, Sousa's concerns are so ridiculous on their face that they hardly need refuting. Echoing the words of Edgar Varèse from a half century earlier, Chattopee argues that, quote, "The electronic musical instrument, in its myriad forms, may turn out to be the most beneficial to humans and the most enjoyable, rewarding, and expressive instrument that has ever existed." I would like to plant myself firmly on the side of John Philip Sousa in this debate. The idea that electronic music technology is more beneficial to humans than all other music is absurd. Whereas Sousa's question about whether children will be put to sleep by machines points right to the heart of the issue of how human beings and their increasingly complex technology are going to coexist. this, in the end, is the issue with which all of my work is engaged. I believe it is the fundamental issue of our time. We see it everywhere, from the smallest scale, where we struggle not to be overwhelmed by our cell phones, iPods, and laptops, to a larger scale where we struggle to contain the unprecedented power of transnational corporations whose vast holdings and operations are made possible only by equally vast arrays of networked computers, and where we confront the enormously destructive power of weapons that are more and more readily available to smaller and smaller groups of people, to the truly global scale of world climate change. If art that makes an if art that makes intensive use of the latest technology is to be relevant in such a world, it must begin from here. How the tense and difficult confrontation of humans and their machines is reshaping and threatening our world. Performance, the uneasiness between the machine and the human body is reflected in the fact that as technology has grown more and more sophisticated, the successful design of instruments that can be manipulated during performance with anything like the fluidity and intuition of conventional musical instruments has remained elusive. I don't attribute this failure, however, to a lack of imagination on the part of artists. Rather, I see it as a reflection in art of the uneasiness of the meeting of the machine and body throughout culture. How machines and bodies will coexist is thus not a problem to be solved, but the central tension of our time in human history, and thus a compelling terrain in which to locate art. But if forays into this terrain are going to go farther than mere advertising for technology, the tensions and difficulties of the body-machine relationship must not be ignored, swept under the rug, glossed over, or hidden by tricks and gadgets, but brought to the front and center, highlighted, magnified, and investigated. This tense relationship between our bodies and our machines is merely one instance of a much bigger uneasiness between machines and life on our planet. This too must not be hidden in the shadows, but illuminated. In this life,
We are enmeshed in an infinitely dense grid of social and physical relations. Art is what happens when we try to interact with this web in a particular way. Make it better? Maybe. But also make it prettier, uglier, louder, quieter, more organized, and more chaotic. Art is making things that are useful. Art is making things that are useless. Art is making things that excite the mind. Art is making things that quiet the mind. Art is inventing systems. Art is breaking rules. Is this all we can say about art? That art is about creating? No. Entrepreneurs are creative, inventing new business methods, product lines, and markets. In fact, the capitalist system is relentlessly creative, but we don't think of it as art. The question is one of intention. Entrepreneurs create in order to make profit. Scientists create in search of falsifiable knowledge. Athletes create in order to win games. Military leaders create in order to destroy the enemy. I think an artist is someone who creates in order to transcend, to rise above the particular and reach for the universal. Now, I know that words like transcendence and universality are quite unfashionable in our postmodern intellectual milieu. They come loaded with a heavy baggage that today is generally seen as conservative. But I use them here in a way that is quite specific, and I ask you to hear me out. A work of art seeks to illuminate some nexus in the dense web of physical and social relations in which we live. Illuminate it so brightly and clearly that we can see it as if from a new angle. Can for at least a moment become unstuck from our unique spot in the grid and see from a new perspective. This coming unstuck is what I mean by transcendence, and the possibility of seeing from a new perspective is what I mean by universality. Within this web of relationships of which I am speaking, let's say that power is the degree to which any relationship is tilted in favor of the person or party on one side of the relationship and against the person or party on the other side. Always, one person or party is more likely to follow the commands of the other. I use commands here in the broadest sense, not only stay off my property, or work for a low wage in my factory, or fight in my army, but also trust in my wisdom, desire the sexual pleasures I wish for you, dream dreams that reinforce my authority, and so on. Politics refers to actions that attempt to change a balance of power in the strands between the nodes of the web, to tilt the balance differently, to shrink one strand and strengthen another, to cut a strand here and make a new connection over there. When feminists declared that the personal is political, they meant that the power imbalances in relations between individuals, merited sustained analysis and struggle for change. Politics in the more conventional sense concerns struggles over balances of power involving large nodes in the web of human relationships. Nodes like states, transnational corporations, and so on. Maintaining a semblance of democracy in an era of globalization implies the need for some way of addressing the balance of power at the scale of the entire web, and it is not at all clear how this might develop. Of course, a lot of political activity involves people who occupy strong nodes in the web seeking to defend their position, or other people trying to push those occupants out of the strong nodes so that they themselves can enjoy the privileges of that real estate. But there is another kind of politics that seeks to restructure the web itself so that power is distributed more evenly. Let's call this insurgent politics. Insurgent politics is necessarily experimental, unruly, and disruptive. It examines, tests, expands, breaks, and restructures the strands between the nodes in the web. It's always centered on struggle. This is so close to my artistic aesthetic that in this light, it is hard for me to even discern the line demarcating art and politics at all. For all my work is in some sense about struggling with the limits of the social and physical world, testing, examining, expanding, breaking, and restructuring, seeking possibility where before there was none, making new connections and rupturing old ones. It is fundamentally about struggle. Others can make peaceful, sonorous music about beauty and symmetry and celebrate the world as it is. For me, struggle is the root, the source. Yet despite seeing art and politics flowing from the same spring, I am not blind to the fact that further downstream they diverge according to differences in intention. Politics is about restructuring the web in which we live. Art is about coming unstuck from it, transcending it, if only for a moment. Insurgent politics is about seeking to draw together a collection of weaker nodes in the web in such a way that the web itself can be restructured to their benefit. This requires focusing on the commonalities that define the collective. It does not imply erasing the individual except in its most totalitarian manifestation, but it does imply, at the very least, de-emphasizing the individual. Art requires an uncompromising truthfulness to oneself, foregoing any intentional appeal to an audience in exchange for a potentially universal appeal to all. Politics, in the end, is about winning, and winning is a concept that is meaningless to art. I don't see myself as swerving back and forth between art and politics, but engaging in a creative endeavor of struggle against the constraints of the web of social and physical relations in which we live. Further downstream, this endeavor forks into politics, which seeks to win, and art, which seeks to illuminate, But upstream, it's just the creative impulse that ultimately gives life meaning. This is what I think of when I think of a creative life. A life whose center of gravity lies upstream, where everything, profession and livelihood, location, even gender and identity, is up for grabs, and we ride the tiger even when it takes blind turns and detours to destinations unknown. This is the realm where the impulse to create leads people to reinvent themselves, where John Cage's musical curiosity led him to reinvent himself as a Zen Buddhist, where Anthony Braxton reinvents himself as rude genius, composer, chess master, and philosopher. It's the realm in which the best of the Central American revolutionaries I worked with in the 1980s reinvented their revolutions in small ways every day, reinventing themselves to the task at hand.
Das war eine Live-Performance im 5.1 Surround mit dem Titel Creative Life von und mit Bob Ostertag. Technik Katharina Böhm und Martin Leitner, Redaktion Elisabeth Zimmermann. Helmut Jasper sagt auf Wiederhören.